It happens in all of our lives to everyone we know, and it will happen to us, and yet we struggle with how to navigate it and talk about it. Death, honouring it can feel wrong, denying it can seem easiest, and we're often left with words we wished we'd said to someone. So this morning on Life Matters, we want to consider those last conversations we have or can prepare to have as we die, or as someone close to us is dying. They're conversations that will be individual to us all. There are no prescriptions here, but we'd like to hear from you. Are there words you said to a loved one, or would like to have said, or feel are important to say as death approaches? 1300 22 55 76. 1300 call RN is the number. 1300 22 55 76. You can get us on the text message as well, 0418 226 576. Text us 0418 226 576. Joining us this morning is Dr. Dale Larson. He's professor in the Department of Counselling Psychology at Santa Clara University in California, and he's in Australia to deliver the keynote address at the Australian Psychological Society's Counselling Psychology Conference in Melbourne this week, I think. He's the author of The Helper's Journey, Working with People Facing Grief, Loss and a Life-Threatening Illness. Dale, thanks for being with us this morning.
Oh, it's a real pleasure to join you.
I'd also like to welcome singer and songwriter Tansy Mayhew, whose mother died a few years ago of motor neuron disease, and she has also lost two brothers, so she's had to do a lot of thinking about this whole conversation. Welcome, Tansy.
Oh, happy to be here.
Good to have you. I'll start with you, Dale. Why are these conversations so important and so important to talk about?
Well, you know, I think we all see it in our lives with our friends as we get older and we see more people dying, we've experienced more of it, that when someone we love dies, there are always unfinished hurts and disappointments and often unexpressed love that are still there. And it's important to think about it as an opportunity for interpersonal healing and wholeness. Forgiving, asking for forgiveness, for example, is a human blessing, but the issue is it's extraordinarily difficult at times. I call all this tough talk or end-of-life conversations in my writings, and I think they are really some of the most difficult and most important conversations in our lives. In the medical arena, they determine the course of care when we're talking about conversations with our medical professionals, and our lives with our family, it really determines how our final days will be.
Yes, so many conversations, aren't there? I mean, from the mundane to almost the sublime, you know, from what we want from pain relief in any given moment to questions about what a life has meant.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's and really important if we're going to be empowered, kind of activated patients in our end-of-life care, that we're asking questions and that we're involved. But what we've found is that very often there's a kind of a collapse of personal efficacy in these situations. So we have to really kind of take that back and be able to ask the questions that we need to ask and get some control. I think the concept of having more control, that there can be a better rather than a less good dying, is a new one very often in the world. And I think the modern end-of-life care movement has really teaching us in hospice care and palliative care that there are different options that we have as we go through this experience.
Dale, we'll come back to this idea that you have of the activated patient, because you observe that while many of us want a quality end-of-life and quality end-of-life care, we avoid the discussions that really enable that to happen. But there is a first conversation that we often have to have with all those around us, and that is to let people know that we are dying. What are the barriers to that very conversation?
We very often protect if we're the patient ourselves. We don't want to unnecessarily or involve our loved ones and make them more frightened. But I think it's usually the family members who are most protective, and they feel that they don't want to talk about this. So we have a real standoff effort,
sort.
Yeah, to not talk about these things. And then that backfires. So, you know, we've done everything we can. We've tried many different approaches to facilitating communication, and it's a tough assignment. It's a tough assignment in all the different areas with family members and with medical personnel, because I think it's all really ultimately about death anxiety, and that it's so terrifying to stare into the sun and to really confront loss and death that we all dance around. And the problem is that in the moment, that's very comforting in a way. But in the end, it leads to less kind of good care. And we have unfinished business, and we have our relationships suffer as a result.
Yes, this point of unfinished business, we'll come back to that too. But yes, we spend so much energy and we put so much effort into living. It's very hard to put energy into that ultimate unknown, isn't there? Tansy Mayhew, your mother had a slow degenerative disease. She knew she was going to die from it.
Yes, she did.
Did that mean that there was more time to talk about her death? And what it would mean?
Yeah, because she took about 15 years for it to kill her. And we had, it wasn't a really encapsulated experience. We had those conversations over a long period of time in between still living life, kind of thing. So it wasn't a huge shock thing that some people have to go through. We definitely had lots of conversations interspersed over a long
period
of time.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
15 years.
In the last few years, I didn't know when she was going to die. So I ended up getting into the habit of calling her every day to talk, just to involve her in life and what was happening in my life, so that she didn't feel so completely out of it.
Did you talk about death?
We did at times. She had very defined ideas on what she wanted to happen after she died and what she didn't. So we had a few arguments about that because I disagreed.
what did you disagree over? She was a very religious woman.
She didn't want me to grieve. And I said, but I will grieve because you'll be gone and I'll miss you. But I don't want you to grieve. And she didn't want a funeral and she didn't want a place where people could go and grieve her. She just wanted to be disposed of quietly where nobody could visit her grave and grieve over.
But how did you navigate that? These are the conversations that people have, and sometimes people can be very stubborn in their dying. They can make very clear decisions and it leaves those of us left really quite tortured by honouring their desires but also honouring our need to also grieve.
Well, I didn't back down from what I needed. I need rituals around death myself, and so I told her that's what I would be doing. But we didn't have a funeral per se. It was just my father, one of my sisters and myself. And we just did our own little ceremonies and that was it. So in that way we honoured her idea of not wanting everybody to be there. But that caused a bit of a fracas in their family too, because they all wanted to come and do that.
And people have very clear expectations about funerals. You had led a very complicated life with your mother. It had been a difficult life. And I guess she disapproved of decisions that you'd made in your life and career, I think.
Lots of them.
Is that understating it?
She grieved, I think, is probably the best way. She just didn't understand and she grieved about it because she'd brought me up to be a certain way and I was absolutely the opposite of that, which often happens.
And there was anger there?
There was anger on both sides, I think, for a long time until we learnt to be more accepting of who we were. I couldn't change the fact that she was very religious and quite dominating and wanted to control everything, and she couldn't change the fact that I'm not a religious person and I'm very free-spirited and probably just as stubborn as she was.
did knowing she was going to die, having a clear sense of that this is going to be finite, this relationship, as complicated and sometimes hardcore that it was, fractious as it was, did that enable some conversations to have that you wouldn't have had otherwise?
Yes, I got to, Mum had some issues and I had trouble with them as a child and I got to discuss those things with her. But I think she always encouraged honesty, and so there was never much, even though she could be a bit of a scary woman sometimes, she always encouraged, you to talk about everything, and she'd dig at you until you did anyway, because she's very perceptive. She just had until you said whatever she wanted to talk about. So, yeah.
I will come to your calls in just a tick, but I do want to just check in with Professor Dale Larson. You know, in those final weeks, Dale, it can be a very confusing time because people have different needs of that time. So you, who isn't dying, might need to unburden, might need to unload some of the difficulties you've had with that person, but you don't want to burden the person who's dying. They're dealing with death. And you've had a great interest in some of the things that get revealed and disclosed at this time in these last days and weeks, haven't you? You've been collecting these stories.
Well, it's a difficult thing to navigate. Like you're saying, you have your needs and the needs of your loved one who's dying, and somehow we're trying to get to some of those conversations that can be so transformative. The please forgive me, I forgive you, thank you, I love you, goodbye. In some form, listening to Tansy, it sounds like she and her mother kind of found a way. You don't have to always talk about dying, but you need to talk a little bit about the relationship. You need to acknowledge what's happened in a way. And it's not always about acceptance. It's about coming to a place in your heart where you forgive each other on some level. And I think we have that in every relationship.
Why do you need to do it? Why do you think we need to do it? Because, yes.
I think it's a very healing thing, because otherwise you, or the survivor, is left with a more complicated kind of relationship. And if you think about everyday life and all our relationships, if we live in a resentment and we don't allow ourselves to kind of move forward, it doesn't mean we accept everything that's happened. And remember that there are some people who have been seriously abused by their parents or by the person who's dying, their spouse. Mm. And there's really not much of a place for acceptance there. And forgiveness is a very difficult thing. So I'm not saying we accept everything that's happened to us in our lives.
I think that's very important to acknowledge, Dale. We've had a very powerful message on our Facebook page from one of our listeners, and he writes, "My father's monologue to me was a declaration of innocence of all his misdeeds. I sat and listened and allowed him that very last lie. Months later, he died alone. Could I have received him better? Yes. Could I have validated him falsely? No. That one can be finally absolved on one's deathbed is a notion that can lead men to believe they can do ill and then have a peaceful rest. I do not condone that, nor forgive its adherents." So that's a very powerful reflection on whether or not we can resolve everything on the deathbed.
That truly is. And I think that one of the things that happens is we're left as survivors still feeling shame, and that we've failed again. And those were often the experiences we had as children growing up. So I don't think that everyone dies in a way that's really taking care of the needs of the people around them. People die the way they lived. And if they weren't taking care of your needs to begin with, they're probably not likely to be thinking about them. Also, people become more egocentric very often when they're dying. On the other hand, sometimes people become almost spiritually more aware and transcendent. There's a window of opportunity. And this is one of the concepts that I think is really important, is that there's a window of opportunity at this time. And some people take advantage of it and some people don't.
Mm.
And when you can take advantage of it, there's a powerfully transformative experience that's there for us all. Because in life, we often don't get to this level of communication and honesty. I think Tansy, when she was saying that her mother really encouraged honesty, that's such an important thing. They had differences and they had disagreements and disappointments, but she was able to be with her. And I think also the point that Tansy was making about rituals is very important, that we need the rituals to get some healing in a time of loss of someone we love.
I'll come to you, Tansy, in just a tick. I want to take some calls now because we've got a full board, as I expected, on this one. Julia in New South Wales, hello there. You're a solicitor and you give talks about getting our affairs in order. This is a very important early conversation to have,
yeah,
isn't it?
More importantly than that, I'm a nursing sister as well, which I think helps my law even better, because I see a lot of very ill people in last stages in hospital. And I also give these talks, which I love to do. They're free, and I'm not promoting myself. I couldn't care less whether I get a job or not from any of them, because I just want people to face the realities of growing old And I always say it in a very comedic way so that I sort of tell them they can show them how to spend all their children's money before they've died in a comedic way, because I want people to get their affairs in order and I want them to help them to face those last days that we'll all have.
Well, certainly people take a great sense of comfort that they've kind of ticked off a list of things, and that, so they're leaving things tidy, don't
yes.
they?
Yes.
And not everyone gets that chance, and that can be terribly hard for family members as well. Julia, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
What a combination, a solicitor and a nursing sister. Excellent. Very skilled combo, I think. Jan in Victoria, hello there.
Hello.
You have an experience with your husband. He knew he was dying.
He did, yes. He'd been ill with leukemia, having lots of treatment in hospital, and they realised there was nothing more they could do for him. So, and he really wanted to die at home. And I was happy to do that because he'd spent such a lot of time in hospital. And the palliative care nurses were absolutely wonderful and did support me. But as soon as Mike, the doctors told him, pardon me, that he wouldn't survive, he, being a managing director, he just got me to call up his small group of friends that he called the usual suspects and sat. We had drinks at 5 o'clock and he sat down with his agenda and said that, you know, he wanted them to come and see him as much as possible. We had one friend who was very good with words, so she was going to write the notice in the paper and gave everybody jobs to do. And then I sent emails to friends interstate. So there wouldn't be a funeral.
He really set about managing his own end of life.
He was in charge, and that was very important to him, particularly as he'd been so ill. And then he said to me a couple of days before he died, we really should sit down and just write out some of the wonderful things that we've done in our 45 years of marriage. And I said, yes, we will, darling, but there were so many things to do around the house, and I didn't get to do it that day, but about midnight I sat down and I wrote a little poem, which I was able to read to him the next day.
Well done.
I'm sorry, I'm emotional. And then it's been such a comfort to me because I've still got it. He read it and was thrilled with it, and then he died quietly the next day.
What a skillful husband you had, Jan.
Yes, it was lovely, and it's a really nice way to go.
Yeah.
And I would encourage anyone, if they possibly can, it depends on the situation. I was lucky because I knew, but if they can have their loved ones at home, there is so much help there now with the professionalism and the caring and the help that I got.
You're so right. Jan, thank you for sharing that. I think you've given some very powerful props to help other people think.
I hope so, because I was lucky to be able to do it. Some people can't when someone dies quickly.
That's right. The skill and wisdom of your husband. Dale Larson, do you have some thoughts there?
Oh, I'm just so touched by that. That Jan's and Mike is a classic example of what I was trying to describe earlier of the activated person, the window of opportunity, the opportunities that palliative care, hospice care provide for dying at home. In the United States, at least 75% of people say they want to die at home, but 75% die in an institution.
People get scared of dying at home. It does take very skilled health professionals, doesn't it, to say, no, it's okay. We've been dying for as long as we've existed on this planet. People die in their home.
But this was just, Mike is just an example personal efficacy in a time like this. We did a national newspaper series in the United States. I was senior editor in 2001. It went out and 7 million Americans read it. And in each of the stories that we had someone like Mike who showed us that, well, here's a way you can deal with this. Here's a way you can take charge at the end of life and take advantage of that window of opportunity. And we're not saying that it's always all pleasant and wonderful, but it can be better rather than less good. And that's just so touching with Jan and Mike. And the poem she wrote is hers forever. And
yes,
I'm sure meant so much to him.
I have a dear friend who died, and she had been writing quietly alone, down verse poetry over the years, and we found it after she died. It was the most incredible. She died very suddenly and it helped us tremendously, I have to say. And it was a private activity, but I think she knew what she was doing. She was leaving a legacy for us. We're talking about end-of-life conversations today, the hardest conversations of all in some respects, and very individual. The number to call is 1300 225 76. Are there things that you've said that made all the difference, or that someone else said as they were dying, the things that they said to you, or the things that you wish you'd said? 1300 225 76, or 1300 call RN, and you can text us 0418 226 576. I'm joined by Professor Dale Larson from the Department of Counselling Psychology at Santa Clara University, and he's a leader in this field. And Tansy Mayhew, Sydney-based singer and songwriter. Tansy, did your mum feel that, did she feel in control towards the end? Was she able to have conversations with her doctors about where she wanted to go in terms of her death and treatment towards her death?
Very much so. She was always taking less drugs than what would have been appropriate to the level of pain that she was in, because most of her life she'd been very health conscious and she didn't like the idea of drugs. But right towards the end, where she became so exhausted and she just really reached that point where she wanted to die now, there was a bit of a skirmish about them increasing the dosage of the drugs that she was taking to the point where it would be an end-of-life kind of dose, which is often what happens, is the drugs are increased to combat the situation to the point where the body can't handle the drugs as
and
much as the disease.
And often made.
Yeah.
Why was there a skirmish?
Well, because my auntie, her sister, has been a geriatric nursing sister most of her working life, and she has administered those medications herself many times, where that's the last medication the person's given. So, but there is a practice of how you go about it. You don't just say, as Mum did, because she misunderstood the communication. She said, okay, I want to die now, give me the dose. That's very close to euthanasia, and of course that's not something the medical practice would do.
But how are you meant to know how to say it, you know, when you need it?
So there was this big, you know, you can't do that, blah, blah, blah. So that's, and it kind of split everybody down the middle for a little while, but it was, instead of being like one big lethal injection, it was something that happened over a week.
I'll ask Dale on that one too. Dale, that's one of the trickiest conversations. You know, doctors are about preserving life, but they're pragmatists too at the end of life. We don't talk about this, but yes, at some point there's a collective conversation where someone says, I've been part of the conversation a number of times, okay, I'm ready now. And a decision is made to up the pain relief.
Well, I think that the goal is always to control pain. Mm. I think that it is true that you can have some decrease in, you know, some of the bodily functions with the control of pain. But the real goal here is controlling the pain, and that's what medical practice does. Mm. I think it's what I'm hearing here, though, is that her pain was not controlled earlier on, and I'm kind of saddened by that, because pain can be controlled, and terminal sedation, which is not a practice, you know, is not a solution to that. I think that you have to find a way to control the pain. So I would have preferred that her mother. I know that it's a struggle, because we all don't want to get addicted to pain medication. This is sort of part of the culture. I'm not sure what it is in Australia, but in the United States, people say, oh, I don't want to take all that pain medication. But we really can control pain. Almost all pain is controllable. And so it's unfortunate if she had her pain controlled and her symptoms controlled. Once people have that pain control, which is usually very effectively provided in hospice and palliative care, then you are not thinking, well, I'd rather just die than experience all this. So I would just hope, you know, it's the right problem but wrong solution that we were thinking of there. We need to really control the pain. And that's why I like early referrals to hospice and palliative care are so important. Tansy, I don't know if your mom was in hospice and palliative care.
My dad was her full-time carer. And so for a long time, that's what the situation that happened. They lived together in a home. But in the last 3 months, he just couldn't manage it anymore because it was 24 hours and he was constantly adjusting her and trying to help her with the pain. And so, yeah, she went to a nursing home. In the last 3 months.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm just cheering for, you know, better pain control.
Yes, indeed.
Once we control the symptoms, then we have a different kind of course, you know, psychological and physical.
That's right, and these are conversations we can have earlier before it becomes really hard to have these conversations. Mm-hmm. I'd like to take just a couple more calls if I can. Andrea in New South Wales, your mother died 12 months ago.
Yeah, just a little over 12 months ago. She had Alzheimer's and passed away in a nursing home. She was there for the last few months. I was with her, you know, when she was sane and competent and she made her will. She had 10 children, distributed the estate equally except for one person, and she had a major reason for that, which was I know she made this decision because it was what she lived by, and now the executors of the will wish to change this situation, which I feel is a total disrespect to and dishonouring her life values. Mm. It's very difficult for me because I'm kind of being relegated as the black sheep because I don't want this sister to have an equal share, which is totally wrong because her children actually are the benefactors, not this particular sibling.
Right.
But it comes back down to values. And my mother lived by this value of her marriage, and she had 10 children, 40-year marriage. And, you know, that was the conversation that she had.
Okay. Andrea, thank you very much for that. And yes, this is a point about honouring those conversations and decisions that people make before they die, isn't it? I might take another call, and that is Louise in Victoria. Your dad died last year, and you discussed dying with him.
Yes, it was fairly difficult with my dad because he was a very strong Dutchman and he'd lived through the war and he'd migrated. And I think always when you have a migrant, they're very strong people because it takes a lot to take yourself away from your family, of course, and start a new life. Anyway, he was an extremely healthy person, but in the last few years he got prostate cancer, but that's not actually what killed him. It was heart failure in the end. But he ended up in a palliative care unit in Geelong, McKellar. It's marvellous. Nurses, doctors, wonderful. But Dad was fighting till the end, and we could see he was getting weaker. And anyway, he didn't really have a good way of expressing himself. So at one stage, we spoke to the doctor and we said, can we sort of withdraw a lot of these medications that were prolonging Dad's life? And the doctor said, yes, that's a good idea. But he said, your father has to agree to it. And he said, do you want me to talk to your dad? Anyway, Dad knew we were having a meeting, but he didn't know what it was about.
Mm.
So he said, don't worry, I will talk. This is the doctor, sorry. I will talk to your dad today and tell him that we can withdraw certain heart medications and that will speed up his suffering and he will gently pass away. So we go back into the room, there's three of us, mum and three sisters, and Dad immediately said, so what's the verdict? So he actually knew that we were talking about his death, even though we'd never actually said it to him in those words. And we said, well, Dad, you're not going to get better. And he said, yes, I know. And he said, well, what will happen? And he said, I want to know. So he was, you know, really focused on what we were saying, And it was almost as though a burden was lifted from him. It was amazing. He just seemed to relax and start talking to us. He hadn't been talking much in the last week, and he said, "Who will look after Mum?"
Mm.
And that was the focus with him. He was worried. And we said, "Oh, we'll look after Mum, Dad." And anyway, in the end, a couple of days later, he just went into a coma. And after 3 days, he passed away.
He was able to release.
Him comfortable.
Information helps, doesn't it?
The information that he got, we just said to him, "Dad, it'll be a peaceful death," and that's how he went.
Thank you very much, Louise. Dale Larson, you talk about the activated patient. It starts from the very moment we know we're going to die.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does. But this is just a beautiful example, the last caller,
isn't it?
Of the family being involved in, because really end-of-life care is family-oriented care. It's person-centered care. And that was just a beautiful moment where the family really broke the ice and talked with him, and then he was able to take charge and say, "Okay, how are you going to take care of my wife? What's going to happen here?" And make some decisions. These are tough decisions. These are not easy decisions to make about medications and how long am I going to – when does dying start? When does living end? Or, you know, when do you begin to die?
That's right.
It's tough to really determine that. There's no clear point, and that's tough for the patient to say, "Well, I now understand that I'm in a terminal kind of situation."
Yes. Tansy, a key thing for you in your conversation with your mother was at one point you gave her permission to die. How did that shift things? Tell us about what happened there.
I'm not sure at that point that it shifted anything, because it was maybe even 3 years before she actually died, but she'd got really bad.
Mm.
And I knew that she worried terribly about all of us, and that was keeping her here. So I just said to her, "You know, if you want to go, okay. You do it. We'll be fine. And she kind of looked shocked, because she wasn't in any way prepared to die just yet. She was,
but she felt you had to prepare yourself and her.
And they're not getting rid of me that easy. But I think right up until the end, that was a balance in her mind of worrying about us and being able to cope with her physical ailments. And it got to the point, I mean, she was a very strong woman, and it got to a point where she couldn't juggle that anymore. And I think it was at that point a relief for her to had at least one of us say to her, "It's okay."
You'd had a difficult relationship. Was forgiveness relevant at all at the end?
Forgiveness wasn't mentioned. There was just a hell of a lot of love. Like, I did lots of her care whenever I could go and visit her, to help Dad out, and also just as an expression of love, and was able to give her what it was that she needed, which was just somebody to be there.
Because you hadn't been able to do this with your brothers, had you, at all?
No.
You'd been totally removed from their deaths.
No. My youngest brother, I wasn't allowed to go to his funeral because we were considered to be too young for the distress of it. With my oldest brother, I have a special needs child, and I only had respite for a certain period of time, so I had to kind of leave before he died. And so did Dad. We went up together to say goodbye. So it was really, really important to me to be with Mum when she died, and I'm so glad that I was. It was one of the most beautiful experiences of my life.
Yes, indeed.
And we were it was just very loving. The conversation almost stopped in terms of discussing the fact that she was dying in those final few months. We just didn't talk about it anymore. We just enjoyed whatever time we could spend together, and had fun with each other and loved each other, and that's pretty much how it was at the end.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Dale Larson, finally to you. I mean, some people don't involve themselves closely with a loved one who's dying because there's a terrible fear. And sometimes the people themselves who are dying don't want to engage with the question of death and what's going to happen.
Well, there are a lot of barriers. Just hearing Tansy, though, say that this is one of the most beautiful experiences in her life is really touching, and also just tells us a lot about the potential there that sometimes we don't think about it that way. We think about it as this awful event. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, one thing she taught us, I don't think the stages really hold up, you know, as real psychological stages.
Yes.
Yeah, no, that we've known that's not the case for a long time. But what she did teach us is that we need to listen to people who are dying. We need to communicate with them, and that was just a beautiful thing that Tansy shared. But there are a lot of barriers, and family members often, I want to say, they're really trying to do the best thing. They're experiencing anticipatory regret. They want to make sure we do everything possible, and that's very understandable because you don't want to live with regret later on. But sometimes the best quality of care and the best end-of-life experience isn't associated with being in the ICU or being in a ventilator. These are not really pleasant and optimal ways to die. And family members sometimes don't realize that, and that there is an alternative. And we need to find a path together with our medical professionals.
Sometimes hard
family.
When you haven't had that relationship with them through your life. Suddenly you've got to kind of reinvent that relationship at the end. Can I thank you both for joining us on the show today, and thank you for all the calls. Professor Dale Larson from Santa Clara University, Department of Counselling Psychology. They're speaking at the Australian Psychological Society's conference. Thank you, Dale.
Thank you very much.
And Sydney-based singer-songwriter Tansy Mayhew, thank you for being with us.
Our pleasure.
And thank you for your calls today. Sorry if we couldn't get to you all. Please keep the conversation going on our website if you'd like to, and our Facebook page. I really am totally moved by many of the things that you put on our Facebook page. There seems to be a great community of conversation going on there, even about conversations as hard as this one about death. So you can head there, or you can email us privately from our website. Just click on the Contact Us. And our listener feedback line, 02 833 1430. Coming up to the news, next on Life Matters, who owns your genes?